We're in chapter 5, I believe. But before we do that, I want to go back over some stuff here. My wife made a suggestion. I should just explain a little more about Esther and her life and what kind of person she was. So in the beginning, we saw that Ahasuerus was the great king. Now Ahasuerus, and there's another place where he's called Artaxerxes. Those are titles, or what they call appellations. Wasn't his name. According to historical sources, his name was Astyages, Astyages. And he's also known as Artaxerxes, and is also the same person that is called Darius the Median in Daniel, as far as it seems. And from his marriage to Esther, he produced a son, Cyrus the Persian, referred to in Isaiah 45:1 and Ezra 6:14. And that's all according to Bullinger's appendix in his companion Bible, Appendix 57. If you want to go back and read it, there's a lot longer, more detailed explanation, and there's a what you call a diagram of the kings and their names, and there's a couple of Dariuses, there's a couple of different names that are several times, first, the second, the third, that kind of thing. We saw in chapter 1 that the king was displeased with Vashti, the queen, and she was thrown out, and so he needed a new queen. And so then they went around the kingdom looking for young virgins to, see which is the best, most beautiful, perfect young woman to be the bride of the king. Esther was that young woman chosen to be the queen. She, her uncle, not her uncle, her cousin Mordecai worked in the palace, and he brought her to the guy that was where all the women were being collected, and they were staying in a special place, and they were preparing them for over a year to go before the king. And then, they'd go through and they'd say, well, she's not quite right, or blah, blah, blah. But when he saw Esther, he did what? He just was taken by her, because it said she was very beautiful and bright. And of course, we know that she was beautiful, but she also was a believer. So she had a, special quality. If you look in chapter 2 real quick of Esther, verse 7 it says, and he brought, he being Mordecai, he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, her name was Hadassah, but Esther here, his uncle's daughter. She had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took her for his own daughter. So Mordecai raised her. Mordecai was this wonderful guy, and he made sure that she knew about Jehovah, right? That was their what they had in their life. Israel was, or Judah especially, was a God-centered culture and society, supposedly, although the reason they got put into captivity is because they screwed it up. But Mordecai was a believing man, and he raised her. And then in verse 15 it says, now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but that Hagan, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. They were getting all dressed up in fancy stuff and all stuff, and she didn't require anything. And Esther was taken unto the king, Ahasuerus, into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the seventh year of his reign. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So that's pretty great. So she was raised by Mordecai, and she was taught to be who she was. She knew she was a Judean. She knew that Jehovah was the one true God, and she knew she was part of that group of people that was in the empire. And she knew about Jehovah and the history of her people. So when she came to the king, she radiated because she had the love of God in her life. Then in chapter 4, verse 15, it says, then Esther made them return Mordecai this answer. So later on, Mordecai's in trouble, and there's this guy Haman. We read about this last week, and he wants to kill Mordecai because Mordecai won't bow to him because he doesn't bow like that. Had to do with idol worship and everything. And so this guy was planning to kill Mordecai. And so when he sent a message to Esther that she needed to do some things, she says in verse 16, go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. And remember that? She went into the king without being invited, right, the penalty was death, unless he extended the golden scepter, which he did. But she was prepared to die. So that's pretty important. So, but she understood, she asks the Jews to fast, and then she says to her handmaids to fast, which would have indicated that they would have put aside time and you know, to pray and fast, right? That's really what it's talking about. So she knew that she had to go to God. Mordecai had raised her to believe and to worship the true God, and that's what took Esther through this whole ordeal. She was pretty brave, and she was very obedient. You know, one of the things we know in the Jewish culture and in the law was that they were to honor their parents, to obey their parents. And he was her parent, and she did exactly what he told her. So that's an indication of how she was raised and how she took to it. She believed it. So now we're going to go back to chapter 6. That's where we left off. And verse 1. And on that night could not the king sleep, and he commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles. And they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthanah and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to slay the king, to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And that's back in the early chapters where Mordecai, after she was queen, he told her that these guys were going to do that, and she related to the queen, to the king, and the king made an investigation. They found out these guys were plotting, and they hung him. Right. So now he didn't realize that it was Mordecai that did that. So he finds out, and the king said, what honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, there is nothing done for him. So, you know, he didn't get a reward. He didn't, you know, he just did it because he was a loyal subject of the king. And the king said, who is in the court? Now, Haman, that's the guy that wants to kill him. That's the one that hates all the Jews and wants to kill Mordecai. And remember, he was what? A Amalekite, right? Mm-hmm. I believe. And we went back and we looked in the Old Testament, in the earlier periods, and the Amalekites were that group of people that God said eventually he would wipe off the face of the earth. There would be no remembrance of them. So Haman is a descendant of the Amalekite kings. And so it says, now Haman was come into the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. Remember, he was preparing a 50-foot gallows, and he was going to hang Mordecai. So pretty great how God works in this situation. And the king's servants said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court, and the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said unto him, what shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? He thought a lot of himself, right? He just thought, man, I got this made. I've done everything I can to endear myself to this king and showed him I'm loyal and all this other stuff. And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought, which the king useth to wear, and the horse the king rideth upon, and the crown royal, which is set upon his head. He's thinking that it's going to be for him. So he's thinking, wow, what would I like to be rewarded with? Well, I'd like the royal clothes and the royal horse and the crown. And let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of the one, the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man with all whom the king delighteth to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. Wow. So it's really a cool setup, right? He's thinking this is going to be for me, and he's asking me, the king's saying, what should I do to honor this guy? And Haman says, well, do all this, and set it up and have a parade for him and honor him and ticker tape and all the other stuff. Because he thinks it's him. Verse 10. Then the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew, and that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. That must have been a dagger right through his heart. It's like he's already pumped. Man, I'm going to get all this stuff. I'm going to be arrayed in the king's clothes, ride on the horse, have a parade, wear the crown. And he says, okay, what do you want me to do? And he says, go get the guy you hate that you want to kill, and he's the one we're honoring. How great is that? Then Haman took the apparel and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and brought him on horseback through the street of the city and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor. And Mordecai came again to the king's gate, but Haman hasted to his horse, mourning and having his head covered. And Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men, and Zeresh his wife unto him. And wise men would probably have been astronomers and astrologers and soothsayers and prognosticators and all those kind of guys. If Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him. And while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared. Remember, the last week we looked and she had prepared a feast and she invited the king and Haman, and Haman thought, wow, and that's one of the reasons he thought he was so honored, because he and the king were the only ones invited to Esther's banquet. And then she went, and they went, and the king said, what do you want? And she said, well, come back tomorrow and I'll tell you what I want, and we'll have another feast. So they went back. So the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther, chapter 7, verse 1, the queen. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? and it shall be granted unto thee. And what is thy request, it shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom. Then Esther, the queen, answered and said, If I have found favor in the sight of thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. Then the king Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, Who is he and where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so? And Esther said, The adversary, the enemy, is this wicked Haman. Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. And Haman stood up to make requests for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. Then said the king, Will he force the queen also before me in the house? And the word went out of the king's mouth. They covered Haman's face. And Harbonah, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, Behold, also the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who he had spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman. Then the king said, Hang him thereon. Mm-hmm. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. I guess so. Mm-hmm. So what a great thing, huh? He was pacified. Wicked Haman, evil Haman. That's what he got. Mm-hmm. Chapter 8, verse 1, it says, On that day did King Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. And the king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, you know, which was the signet ring, the thing that, because he was the right-hand man of the king, and he sealed all the royal documents, right, the legal documents. He took that ring off of Haman's finger, and he gave it unto Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So the king gave the house to, I guess, Zeresh and her band got kicked out. They got evicted. And Esther spake yet again before the king and fell down at his feet, besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite and his device that he had devised against the Jews. Then the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, If it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews, which are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that shall come unto my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? And again, what did this do? Well, we know that the devil, the adversary of God, one of the things he always tried to do was to destroy the line of the Messiah. Right. You know, the Messiah was prophesied of throughout the Old Testament by all the prophets. And it was prophesied of that it would come from the line of Abraham. And then it was prophesied that it would come from the line of David. And David was of the family of Judah, or the tribe of Judah. And so these were the people that were going to be destroyed. And it says over the whole kingdom, over all the provinces, everywhere, they were going to wipe them out. That would have wiped out that line. So this really saves the line of the Messiah, the bloodline that Jesus Christ came from. So verse 7, Then King Ahasuerus said unto Esther, the queen, and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and him have they hanged upon the gallows, because he laid his hand upon the Jews. Write ye also for the Jews, as it liveth you, liketh you, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring. For the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring, may no man reverse." Then were the king's scribes called at that time in the third month, in the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day thereof. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded unto the Jews, and to the lieutenants, and to the deputies, and the rulers in the provinces, which are from India unto Ethiopia, and 120 27 provinces, unto every province according to the writing thereof, unto every people after their language, and to the Jews according to their writing and according to their language. You know, the kingdom from India, if you know what it looks like on a map, all the way to Ethiopia, which is a gigantic amount of land, for sure. Now, how far into India, we don't know. You know, I don't know that they had exact boundaries back then, but it's an enormous amount of land. It covered the whole Middle East. So that's what he did. And then, let's see. Verse 10, and he wrote in the king Ahasuerus' name and sealed it with the king's ring and sent letters by post on horseback and riders on mules, camels, and young dromedaries, wherein the king granted the Jews, which were in every city, to gather themselves together and to stand for their life, to destroy, to slay, to cause to perish all the power of the people and province that would assault them, both little ones and women, and to make the spoil of them for prey. Upon one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, namely upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, the copy of the writing for a commandment to be given to every province was published unto all the people, and that the Jews should be ready again that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. So the posts that rode upon the mules and camels went out, being hastened and pressed by the king's commandment, and the decree was given at Shushan the palace. And Mordecai went out in the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness and a feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. So that's pretty interesting. So,
yeah.
Now we're going to go down chapter 9, verse 28. Skip over that, some of the stuff there. And it says in 28, and that in those days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city, that these days of Purim should not fall from among the Jews, nor the memory of them perish from their seed. Then Esther the queen, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew wrote with all authority to confirm the second letter of Purim. And that was a feast of Purim, which the Jews still celebrate today, because they celebrate the saving of the Jews in the kingdom of Persia, or the empire of Persia, really. Then he sent letters unto all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth, to confirm these days of Purim in their times appointed, according to Mordecai the Jew and Esther the queen, and had enjoined them, and as they decreed for themselves, for their seed, the matters of the fasting of their cry. and their cry. And the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. So that's how the Feast of Purim came about. And then in chapter 10, the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea. A tribute means tax. He taxed them. And all the acts of his power and his might and his declaration, the greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was next unto the king Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking wealth of his people, and speaking peace to all his seed. So that's pretty cool. Now, remember there was a section in the Greek Old Testament, which is not in King James. So remember in the beginning we read a part and there was a section.
Right.
Well, there's a section at the end also. So it says, and Mardochius, which is Mordecai, said, these things have been done of God. For I remember the dream which I had concerning the matters, for not one particular of them has failed. There was the little fountain, which became a river, and there was a light, and that sun, and the much water. The river in Esther, whom the king married and made queen, and the two servants are I, and Amen, and or Haman, I guess, and the nations are those nations that combined to destroy and came of the Jews. But as for my nation, this is Israel, even they that cried of God, or cried to God, and were delivered, for the Lord delivered his people, and the Lord rescued out of all the calamities, and God brought such signs and great wonders as have not been done among the nations. Therefore did he ordain two lots, one for the people of God and one for all other nations. And those two lots came for an appointed season and for a day of judgment before God and for all nations. And God remembered his people and vindicated his inheritance. And they shall observe these days in the month of Adar, on the 14th and on the 15th day of the month, and the assembly and joy and gladness before God throughout the generations forever among his people Israel. In the fourth year of the reign of Ptolemy and Cleopatra, Dositheus, who said that he was a priest and a Levite, and Ptolemy his son, brought in the published letter of, I can't read the guy's name, Fure, which they said existed, and which Lysimachus, the son of Ptolemy, who was in Jerusalem, had interpreted. And that's how it ends in the Septuagint. Okay? So the record of Esther, she wasn't a man of God, but she was certainly a great woman who believed God, and Mordecai was a great man. Doesn't tell us a whole lot else about him, but certainly it was important. God put it in his word. And it's a great record of people that loved God and believed. Now, in our continuing study of the men of God, we have looked at a great majority of the men of God in the Old Testament. We have looked at most of the books of the Old Testament, but we passed over a couple. Passed over Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Lamentations, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Micah, Nahum, and Malachi. I think. I'm pretty sure that's what we need to do. Now, some of these are just prophecies, you don't really know much about the people. But I did want to look at Job real quick. And we should be right there because it's the next book after Esther. We're not going to go through the whole thing. If you want to learn more about Job or study it, there's several great writings about it. I think Walter Cummins has it in one of his books, right? And Dr. Worrell did a short one in one of his books, and I forget who else. But then Bullinger also did a whole book, I think, on Job. So, Job is considered to be the oldest book in the Bible. I don't know how you determine that exactly, but it is pretty old. So in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright and one that feared God and eschewed evil." Perfect means faultless, upright, just or righteous. But he feared God and he eschewed evil, meaning he had great respect for God. He was in awe of God. And he avoided evil. He tried to stay away from evil. And there was born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. So he was, he had more money than Elon Musk or who else. He was really well to do. And the story goes on that, the devil went before God and he said, "You bless Job no matter what. And if you took away all his good stuff and all his, and afflicted him," and God says, "Well, you can do anything, but you can't kill him." And then he gets sick and he gets boils and his kids die. And then finally his wife says, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" And he refuses. And throughout the whole book, Job never curses God, never blames God. But he has these guys that keep visiting him, and they're called his miserable comforters. And they're always given these reasons why all this happened to him. "Well, you must have sinned somewhere. You must have done this. You must have done that." So on and so forth. And Job says, "No, I didn't." And God's judgments are just, and whatever it is, I'm just gonna have to live with it. So anyway, you can read the whole thing, but we're gonna go to chapter 40. It's a real quick summary, isn't it? Hold on. It's 40-something chapters. I didn't think we want to read through all those discussions and conversations and accusations. But chapter 40, I'm going to read some verses. "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said," now see, all these guys had come along and they had accused him all this stuff. And who's behind accusations?
Adversary.
The adversary, the devil, right? And these guys, Eliu and I forget their guy, Bildad and all these guys, they came and they accused Job of things. They really weren't from God. They tried to appear to be godly. They spoke like they were from God and they were very religious, but they accused him. So, "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, Shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproveth God, let him answer it." Who can contend with God? Who can reprove God? "Then Job answered the Lord and said, Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer thee? I will lay my hand upon my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer, yea, twice, but I will proceed no further. Then answered the Lord unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, Gird up thy loins now like a man. I will demand of thee and declare thou unto me." He said, okay, forget all this stuff. Let's stand up and be a man. But you know what's cool about this? God's talking to Job. So that puts him in the category of a man of God. He's having a conversation with God. So whether how God did it, whether he put his spirit upon him or phenomena or whatever, God's talking to him. And this book was written. Verse 8, wilt thou also disannul my judgment? Wilt thou condemn me that thou mayest be righteous? Hast thou an arm like God, or canst thou thunder with a voice like him? Deck thyself now with majesty and excellency, and array thyself with glory and beauty. Cast abroad the rage of thy wrath, and behold everyone that is proud, and abase him. Look on everyone that is proud, and bring him low, and tread down the wicked in their place. And he's going on, and he's giving them all this information, and so on. So he's giving them a pep talk. Now let's go to chapter 42. So God goes on, he keeps talking to him through chapter 40 and 41. Then in 42, then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understand not, things too wonderful for me which I knew not. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eyes seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in the dust and ashes. He's humbling himself before God. He said, as much as I had, I'm really worthless. I'm vile. And I've seen you, and I'm just in the dirt and muck. And it was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. These guys came, and if you read through the different conversations, the different discourses of these guys, they sound so very religious, they talk about God and they accuse Job. But what does God say? You didn't represent me. You didn't speak what I would have had you speak, not like my servant Job. And when he calls him his servant Job, that's a big deal. When God calls a man his servant in the Old Testament, that means that guy is obedient and he's tracking with God. He's listening. He's willing to do what God would have him to do. Verse 8. Therefore, take unto you now seven bullocks and seven rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, in that ye have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job. So he says, okay, you guys get your act together, get some sacrifices, and bring them to Job, and Job will present them to me. I'll accept it from Job. I won't accept it from you. It's kind of like, if this is truly, the oldest book, it's before the law, right? It's before the Levitical priesthood. And back in the days of the patriarchs, people would go to God and they would make sacrifices. Abraham made sacrifices and so on. But it was would you know if it was a good sacrifice, God would accept it. If it was a bad sacrifice like Cain, God didn't accept it. So he said, you give it to Job and I'll accept it. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite went and did according to as the Lord commanded them. The Lord also accepted Job. And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. So when Job did what God said, and he prayed for his friends and presented the sacrifice for his friends, and then his captivity was turned. That's pretty great. It's kind of like remember when Abraham and he prayed for the king. What was his name? Because this whole kingdom was sick and they were going to just die off. And he prayed for him and he got healed. And then the king turned around and freed Sarah and enriched Abraham, gave him riches. So here the same thing happened. His captivity was turned and he had twice as much. God gave him twice as much as before. Then came there unto him all his brethren and all his sisters and all that had been of his acquaintance before, and did eat bread with him in his house. And they bemoaned him and they comforted him over all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. Okay, it wasn't the Lord that brought it on him, was it? It was that the devil did it. God just didn't restrain the devil, but he protected him. He didn't allow him to kill him. Every man also gave him a piece of money, and every one an earring of gold. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning, for he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, and 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 she asses. He also had seven sons and three daughters. So he had the same amount of kids again in the reasoning is that all his sons will be with him at the resurrection, so he'll have double the amount of kids. And he called the name of the first Jemima, and the name of the second Keziah, and the name of the third Keren Hapuk. And in all the land there were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job, and their father gave them inheritance among their brethren. After this lived Job 140 years, and saw his sons and his daughters, sons, even 4 generations. So Job died being old and full of days.
Yeah, I guess he was.
So, but he was a man of God, you know, and you know, we could go through all the details and all the conversations, but God spoke to him. And God accepted his sacrifices, and God worked with him and blessed him. So that's pretty much a man of God. So that's pretty cool. Okay, next, Hosea.
Wow.
We're not going to get through this tonight, but we'll start Hosea. Some of these we won't go through because there's not a lot to learn except, you know. It's just a prophecy. But in the case of Hosea, it's a pretty juicy story. Well, it is. Hosea was a prophet that was contemporary with Amos in Israel and with Isaiah and Micah in Judah. Okay, so that's before the captivity, right? It's up to the time when the Assyrians came and took Israel, the northern kingdom away. And I think we'll probably just do the first chapter and call it a night. So right off the bat, what does it say? The word of the Lord came unto Hosea. So that right away marks him as a prophet, right? The word of the Lord came to him, and he was the son of Beeri in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. So if you go back in Second Kings and Chronicles, you're going to see where this guy sets up with these guys, or in Isaiah, you know, because that's when Hezekiah was. But of course, Hosea served in Israel. The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. The Lord said to Hosea, go, take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. So here he is, he gets his first assignment from God. And God says, okay, Hosea, I want you to go find a whore and marry her. That's a pretty crazy thing to say, huh? And then you're going to have kids with this whore. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim. She's to blame, which conceived and bare him a son. Wow, that's pretty wild. He just did it. See, and another great attribute of a man of God is when God tells him to do something, he just does it. He obeys. Now, there are times when men of God have said, "Are you sure, God? You really want me to? I'm not sure I want to do this." Right? You know, you can remember the stories of Moses when he was up on the mountain and God called him and he said, "I don't think I'm the right guy. I don't speak well." You know, and God said, "I don't care. You're going to do what, this is what I called you to." Or Jeremiah, you know, and he said, "You know, I'm just a child." And he said, "That's okay." And he put the fiery coals on his lips. Said, "I'll teach you what you need to know." So here, this Hosea, you know, God tells him to go marry a whore, and so he did it. And the Lord said unto him, call, okay, let's see. And she bare him a son. And the Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. What is that all about? Well, Jezreel is a city, and Jehu started out to be looked like a godly guy, and God said, "I want you to go avenge me of Ahab." And the sons of Ahab were in Jezreel, so Jehu said he sent messengers to the city of Jezreel, and he said, "I want the heads of the seven sons of Ahab." So they chopped off the heads of the seven sons and they sent them to Jehu. And they thought, well, everything's cool now. And then Jehu went in and slaughtered all the people of Jezreel, which was not what God wanted them to do. So here he says he's going to avenge Jezreel. So he names his son, the son of Hosea, is named Jezreel. Okay, that's why he named him that. And will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. So, you know, because Jehu took over as the king of Israel. And it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And she conceived again and bare a daughter. And God said unto him, call her name Lo Ruhamah. For I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, I will utterly take them away. And the name Lo Ruhamah means no pity or no mercy. The prefix Lo means no, and Ruhamah means mercy or pity. That's why she was named that. You wouldn't want to name your daughter that. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by now, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horse, nor by horsemen. Now, when she had weaned Lo Ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, call his name Lo Ami, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. Wow, that's a pretty stiff statement. Lo Ami means Ami is people. He says, not my people. And that's the way it is. That's what he's telling these people of Israel because they had turned their backs on God. They were worshiping idols and other gods. Verse 10, yet the number of children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. And it's a prophecy of the future that someday, you know, they would again be God's people. And then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together. God bless you. And appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land. For great shall be the day of Jezreel. And I think we're going to stop right there. Okay? And we'll carry on next time. and we'll see what happens with Hosea, a great man who was incredibly obedient to God, and I'm sure it wasn't an easy thing to do. Because if he married a woman of ill repute, people probably looked at him very strangely. And yet he was a prophet, and God, that's what he told him to do. So he did it.